Good evening. Let's open the Bible tonight to 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter, second chapter, a text that we did not pay much attention to this morning. I called attention to it momentarily, but we moved on to other things, and several of these texts will serve us well in a number of different lessons during the week together. It's good to see you tonight. I'm appreciative of you being here. Your presence is indicative of your interest in spiritual things, and that's certainly commendable. We've been talking today in the prior lessons. If I can get this to... Okay. Wayne, you're right. It's doing funny things here. Okay. All right, we want to talk tonight about the undenomination. We use that phrase, undenominational Christianity, and that's a popular term in many circles. There are people who do not like organized religion. They're turned off by all of the denominational machinery and all of the hierarchy and all of the church officials and the pomp and circumstance and so forth. That's attractive to some people, to be sure, but it's also a turnoff to many people who don't care for that kind of thing. And all of the different misuse of funds and the sexual immorality and all of the child abuse scandals that have plagued different denominations, there are people who simply see the denominational structures of the world as something that's bad. And so the idea of undenominational, non-denominational Christianity is a very popular kind of an idea. So tonight I want to talk a little bit about the undenomination, what we read in the Bible. And then as we have time to segue into what we'll be talking about the rest of the week, which is how did we get to all these different denominations? How did we get from what we read in the New Testament? And I think this text in 2 Peter gives us a clue as to how that happened, because as we saw in other passages in 2 Thessalonians and in 1 Timothy chapter 4, which we looked at this morning, we find that indeed God has predicted that this would happen. Start in the first part, verse of chapter 2. But false prophets also arose among the people. That's a known fact. Anybody who reads the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, sees over and over and over and over again the arising of false prophets, false teachers, the falling away of the Israelite nation again and again and again. If you never read the book of Judges, look at the book of Judges and you'll see that. It's such a mess that I know people who start to teach through the book of Judges and they quit when they get to about chapter 17 because it's almost a soap opera and it has everything from ethnic cleansing to civil war to tribal warfare to all sorts of immorality and concubinage and you name it, and it's there. I'm glad they haven't made a soap opera out of it because we know what Hollywood does to that sort of thing. But this text talks about that. There were these false prophets who arose. Just as there will also be false teachers among you. The idea that this has already happened takes this out of the realm of the hypothetical or the theoretical. There are individuals who hold to a once saved, always saved kind of a doctrine that we looked at briefly this morning. And they will say, well, that hypothetically, yes. That could happen. After all, you get more than 100 passages in the New Testament that talk about falling away and apostasy and so forth. So you can't deny that those texts are there, but it's just hypothetical or theoretical. A Christian really never actually falls away. Theoretically, they could. That's one argument at least that Calvinists will make. Well, this text says that actually happened. It's not hypothetical. And indeed, it goes on to say that this will happen among you. They will bring in destructive heresies, denying the master who bought them, bringing swift destruction upon themselves. And many will follow their sensuality. They appeal to the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eye and the boastful pride of life. And those are powerful tools of the devil. And many will follow them. And not only that, the way of truth will be maligned. Many will follow them. It's not just their own destruction. But they're going to take numbers of people with them. And then after some more Old Testament examples of that, come down to verse 14, for example, and read how the text describes these people having eyes full of adultery. They're looking for, that's what that idiom means. They're on the, not just that they commit adultery because it happened, but they're out searching for opportunities to be immoral. They never cease from sin. They entice unstable souls. They have a heart trained in greed, not just happenstance greediness, but they have exercised their senses to become greedy again and again and again. Accursed children. And then he says, forsaking the right way. Let me ask you a question. How do you forsake a way that you were never in? That's the argument that some people, well, people fall away, yes, but what that means is they were never really a Christian. They were never really in the way. That's not what this text says. What this text says is that they were in the right way and they forsook the right way. And lest we miss the point, they have gone astray. How do you stray from a path you were never on? These are people that Peter is writing about, maybe even writing to some of them, saying, you need to be careful because this can fall away. And if that's not enough, come down to verse 20, where he gets about as graphic as you would care to get. If after they have escaped the defilements of the world by the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, they were in the way, they were on the path, they've been washed, they've escaped the defilements of the world, they have become Christians through the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, and then are again entangled in them, overcome, the last state has become worse for them than the first. It would have been better for them not to have known the way of righteousness than, having known it, to turn away from the holy commandment handed to them. It has happened to them according to the true proverb, which is, a dog returns to its own vomit, or a sow after washing returns to wallowing in the mire. I didn't grow up on a farm, but my dad took me out to my great uncle's farm every summer, I think, just to teach me what happens on a farm, what farmers do. I have had the privilege of slopping hogs and trying to, in other ways, induce them to do certain things, and they're just dirty animals. They're unclean animals in every way you can imagine. And what the apostle's saying is, that's what you do when you go back into sin. That's what you do when you fall away from the Lord. You've gone back to the hog slop and just get around and roll in it, and eventually maybe eat the stuff that's like the prodigal who wanted to fill his belly with the stuff that hogs eat. Nasty. So these texts that we've read today from 2 Peter and 1 Timothy chapter 4 and 2 Thessalonians 2 are just three of dozens, more than 100 passages that talk about this. And that's really what we're doing this week, is using these texts as a kind of a springboard to say that what these apostles warned in the very first century was going to happen, like it happened all through Old Testament history, that actually happened. We're going to look at that's what we're doing this week, is looking at examples of how these texts that predicted the falling away, that's how this came to pass. But I want to start with tonight going back to the idea of what is the New Testament church. Because if we're going to understand how denominations developed, we need to have a very clear picture of what the New Testament church is. So let's start with the idea. What does the word church mean anyway? We're going to talk about undenominational Christianity. Well, it comes, as many of you know, from a Greek word, ekklesia. And sometimes people will use that word, bring it right over into English. There are some people who think that's a good way to describe the church, because it's been so, the water's been so muddied and so ill-defined and so forth. Let's just use the word. Well, that doesn't help us that much. The word actually is a compound word. It comes from two Greek words, ek and kaleo. The word kaleo you would recognize because our English word call, C-A-L-L, is a cognate. It comes straight over from that. And the word kaleo means to call. And the word ek, a preposition meaning out of, you put them together, forms a compound word that simply meant to be called out. Sometimes it was used in Greek usage to mean called out of a larger group into something more specialized. We'll see some examples of that. Turn back to 1 Peter chapter 2, for example, and notice in verse 9, 1 Peter chapter 2, and verse 9, we read, you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who has, what? called you out of darkness. That's the same word that's used here. Into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, now you're the people of God. He's using Hosea, quoting from him. You remember Hosea was told to take a woman who became a prostitute, and he couldn't even tell who, when she had children, whose children they were. And so one of them was named, Lo Ami, not my child, and I will have no mercy, Lo Ruhama. And then later their names were changed to my people or my children. And that's what he's saying here. You once were not God's people, but now you are. You once had not obtained mercy, but now you have received mercy. Why? Because God has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Or we can see examples. Often what this word came to mean and came to be used as in common Greek usage was just as an assembly. A group of people that were called together, some of them called to a specific purpose. Let's look at Acts chapter 19. The Bible uses this word actually in a number of these different ways. And we can see that in the incident at Ephesus when the theater, the whole crowd rushes into the theater and they cry for several hours, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians," and people are fearing for Paul's life and so forth. And finally the city clerk gets up and dismisses them. But look at verse 32, for example, where we read, "So then some were shouting one thing and some another, for the assembly," the ecclesia, that's that word, "was in confusion, for the majority did not know for what reason they had come together." They just sort of following the crowd, literally. The Ephesus Theater, some of you may have been there, will seat something like 19,000 people, I think. They still use it for public gatherings and concerts even today. And so you get all these people who have come to watch what? They don't know. And so they were in confusion. But if you come on down a little bit later, notice in verse 39, we read where the town clerk is speaking, trying to calm the assembly down. "If you want anything beyond this, it shall be settled in the lawful assembly," the legal ecclesia. Here, he means something like the city council. Now, what is the city council? These are individuals who are elected, they are selected, they are called out of the larger population to assemble together for city council meetings. That's the idea that's involved here. And then in verse 41, after saying this, he dismissed the assembly, this group of people who now has quieted down. They're no longer just a mob shouting one thing and another, and nobody really knows what's going on. Now they have become an assembly of people. And so this word ecclesia in Greek really was not a religious term originally, but the Bible writers borrow it by the Holy Spirit and use it to describe Christians who are called out of the world, called out of darkness into the marvelous light of God's love and grace. But they also assemble together. That's basically what the word means. And you can see other examples of that in passages like 1 Corinthians 1 and 2, verse 9 of 1 Corinthians 1. "You have been called together" is the idea. So it's a common usage throughout the New Testament. We won't read all these passages. Now, in the New Testament, I can find two usages, two basic ideas of this usage of ecclesia or church. We sometimes call it the universal church, and that's not a term that's ever used exactly, but the idea is that. If somebody has a better term for it, I would be all ears. But what I mean by that is all the saved everywhere of all time, every generation, every tribe, kindred, tongue, and nation all over the earth, and not just in the present time. I've sometimes wondered, I wonder if we could have an internet church of Christ where people that I've known and worked with and baptized in China or Lithuania or Russia or wherever, or Colombia where Wayne's been and wherever, wouldn't it be cool in a sense if we could have like a 24 time zone split screen and Christians all over the world on the Lord's Day could see what's going on? But even if you could do that, that wouldn't be the universal church, because most of the universal church is dead. Most of the Christians whose names are enrolled in the Lamb's Book of Life are no longer living. So this universal church, all the saved everywhere of all time, over centuries, the only place that church will ever meet, will ever assemble, will ever gather, will ever function is in heaven. And what a glorious assembly that will be as we sing in the hymn. But most of the time, the word church, let me use one text to illustrate. Come over to Hebrews chapter 12, where I think you have an explicit usage of this. Most of the time it's used about local assemblies, but here you get this idea of the universal church and so forth. He says, Hebrews chapter 12, reading at about verse 22, you have not come to the Old Testament sites, but you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to myriads of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn, that's plural, and some translations render it correctly, firstborn ones, whose names are who are enrolled in heaven. And to God, the judge of all, and the spirits of righteous men make perfect. I mean, just think about that assembly where all of the people of all ages, every Christian who's ever lived, everyone who the Lord judges to be faithful to Him will assemble in the heavenly realms and will praise the Lord and cast our crowns down before the crystal sea as we sing. There's that sense of the word church. But most of the time in the New Testament, this one's non-functional. It's not ever going to meet, not on earth. Most of the time it means a local congregation. And out of the many things, let's just look at a couple of examples of that over in the book of Galatians, chapter 1 and verse 22, as Paul is giving some of the details of his life to validate his apostleship. He says, I was unknown by sight to the churches of Judea which were in Christ, local churches. Now, that condition changed by the time he addressed Herod Agrippa. Galatians is an early New Testament, probably the earliest of the epistles to be written, maybe even before 1st, 2nd Thessalonians, but about in that early time. And by the time you get to Acts 26, that changed. Paul says he was known by face to these various churches, and we'll talk about when that happened in just a few moments. When he took a collection for the relief of the poor saints in Acts 11, he distributed it to all of these churches, to the elders in every church, and that's how he went from being, in this text, unknown by sight or by face, literally, to the churches of Judea, to being known to all of them. It's only one of his five visits in the book of Acts that could have happened. But my point here is, that's a description of these local churches, or 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 1, a text that we often use to talk about the contribution and the things that are done. Actually, from 11 to 16, you have all of the collective items or acts of worship that we do concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, to which letter we just read from. And so Paul is talking about these local churches, and that's how the word is normally used, and it's what we normally mean by church when we say the Fort Logan Church or the church in Downers Grove or wherever it might happen to be, the Expressway Church in Louisville or wherever. That's a local congregation overseen by local bishops, and that's the only functioning unit of the church that I can read about in the Bible. The only way Christians come together to actually function as a unit, to function collectively, is in a local church, in a local ecclesia, a local congregation. So let's start with that as a kind of a baseline. And then if we ask the question, what is the church of Christ? What do we read about these local churches in the New Testament? I'm going to quickly sort of go through this. This actually is an entire series in its own right. But if you look at texts like 1 Philippians chapter 1 and verse 1, Paul to the saints in a particular location, in this case Philippi, with the bishops and deacons. So he's addressing Christians in a given locality, and they're overseen by bishops or officers. They were told to appoint elders in every church. And so they did. Their qualifications that are listed in 1 Timothy 3 and Titus chapter 1. Someone who's an elder must be able to teach and convict the gainsayer, must be the husband of one wife, must have raised faithful children, on and on and on. The list of things goes. I would suggest also that there are other texts that talk about their responsibility. It's not just a list of check the box, tick off the box qualifications. That's important. Don't misunderstand me. But like most job applications, what you also get, in addition to, if you read a job application online or if you still get it in the newspaper, it'll say you have to have certain qualifications. You need to have, a commercial driver's license or a college diploma or a high school diploma or something. And you need to, things that you've done in the past that prove basic competencies. But then it will say something like, must be able to work with people, must be willing to travel, must have knowledge of computer programs, must be willing to work nights, must be what, you know, whatever. It's a job description of what the person is supposed to be able to do, not just what certificates they've amassed in the past. That's important. And so in addition to the qualifications that are given in the Bible, we also get a description of what the responsibilities are. What is an elder supposed to be able to do? Not just to mind a checkbook. They're not, as I've heard elders say, well, we got to give account for the money. Well, go back and read that text. That's not what that says. I mean, it's important, yes, that the Lord's money be spent in appropriate ways. Don't misunderstand me, but that text says we're going to give, elders are going to give account for souls. They are shepherds. They are pastors. They oversee the work. It is true. And they have to have some organizational skill. If you look at the list of qualifications, that doesn't describe a guy who couldn't organize a two-car parade. You have to have some, there's some administrative overseeing ability to be sure. But basically, they're shepherds. And so you get in the Bible not only a tick box check of qualifications, but descriptions of how do they shepherd? What did elders do? What were they supposed to be able to do? So that's a part of New Testament church. New Testament church is assembled. And you get text telling, don't be in the custom of forsaking, the habit of forsaking the assembly. And there are all kind of texts that deal with that. When churches assembled in the New Testament, I can read about these activities. Turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 14, for example, where we read about singing and praying and teaching to edification. What is it Paul says, 1 Corinthians 14 and verse 15, I will pray with the mind or the spirit, also with the spirit and the mind also. I will sing with the spirit and I will sing with the mind also. So the correct motivation, but also guided by the intellectual ability of the mind. And in the same context, we already read 1 Corinthians chapter 16. They were instructed to give of their means. They observed the Lord's Supper as described in a lengthy text in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. So you get all of these activities. They taught each other. That's also in Acts chapter 20, but there are regulations given here. It needs to be done decently and in order. It needs to be done to edification. Paul says, even if you're a tongue speaker and are endowed with that ability, if nobody can translate for you, then you need to sit down and shut up. It would be better, he says, to speak five words with understanding that could edify than to speak the most magnificent 10,000-word sermon in an unknown tongue that nobody can understand. And so when I read the Bible, I read about churches assembling, ecclesias coming together, those that are called out of the world coming together, called together in assembly, and they do these things. Now, what did they do with the money that they received? I'm not trying to say that that's not important. And I can read about three basic financial activities, if you will. They supported gospel preaching. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul says, I robbed other churches. That's a metaphor. He didn't literally commit grand larceny. Well, how did he rob other churches? Taking wages of them that I might do you service. Paul was paid for services rendered. This was not benevolence. This was not given to him out of the goodness of the congregation's heart or the churches that supported him. He performed a service. They paid him wages, just like you do when you go to your job. Do you consider the paycheck that you get at the end of the week or the end of the month? Is that benevolence that your employer is just so good-hearted that he decides to give you money? Or is that wages that you probably think you earned every dime of? Well, that's how Paul describes this here. My dad worked for the Indianapolis newspapers for a long time, and he would actually volunteer to work days like Christmas, which we didn't, of course, celebrate as a religious holiday because they pay him double time or two and a half or triple time in some instances if it fell on a Sunday. And he said that's the only time they ever paid him what he's worth. So that's probably how most of us look on wages, is we earned every dime of it. And that's how Paul describes it here. They also assisted needy saints. I can read nine examples in the Bible of where one church sent to another congregation temporarily for the relief of those who were in physical or financial need. And then there was edification of the body, Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 12, that which every joint supplies, whatever is required for the buildup of the body. If we need teaching supplies, if something will expedite the teaching of the gospel, if we decide to put it through a microphone and maybe a speaker and put it on a podcast or record it and send it out on a CD, though most people don't have CD players anymore. But we decided to do that. If we decided to put it on the overhead so everybody can read it, whatever it is, if we decide to have songbooks so that we can all sing together, whatever expedites or helps us do these things that are commanded, that are exemplified in the New Testament, that's what we read about Christians doing. And then finally, they discipline members. They had certain rules about who can and who can't be a member. And if someone misbehaved, particularly in a way that Paul describes in 1 Corinthians 5, where he says, guys, not even pagans do that. The kind of behavior that you're tolerating, and not only tolerating, but actually applauding, actually supporting, encouraging, is the kind of sexual behavior that even pagans don't do that. And so he says, when you come together, deliver such a one to Satan for the mortification of the flesh, and so forth. Now, I can read about those activities. If there's something else that churches need to be doing, if churches need to be involved in family life centers, or if they need to clinics for English, teach English as a second language, or build hospitals, or have medical and dental clinics, those are all good works. But is that the work of the church? Is that what Jesus died for? Is that the kind of church that Jesus wants? We'll talk a little bit more about that later in the week. But my point here is, if we're supposed to be doing that, then we ought to find a text in the Bible that says that. There ought to be some passage somewhere that tells us this is a work that the church ought to be doing. The church ought to be doing the work of the country club or the hospital or the public school or whatever it might be. I don't read about that. Now, those are all good things, but that falls in the realm of the school or the government or private sector economics or whatever. It's not part of what the church did. So when we ask the question, what is the Church of Christ? Let me just summarize what that is. It's an organization. That is, it is some kind of organized body, an ecclesia, that has officers and assembly times and activities and pooled resources, financial, in order to do the financial work, and it has certain disciplinary procedures. And that's probably true of nearly any kind of organization that you want to talk about. I've used the example, some of you have heard me use this before, the Rotary Club, for instance. What is the Rotary Club? Well, the Rotary Club is an organization that has officers, and it has certain assembly times. You drive into a town, you'll see a Rotary Club sign. A lot of cases, it meets Friday at 12 noon at the Holiday Inn or something like that. Certain activities that it does, they may do certain benevolent works in the community, may have a pancake breakfast or whatever. They have certain pooled resources. They take their money and they use it, and they have certain disciplinary procedures. You can't be in the Rotary Club or the Kiwanis or like that and miss a bunch of meetings. If you're going to be a member of that organization, you have to participate in the organization. And if you miss X number of meetings or you don't participate in the activities, then you can't any longer be a member. So I'm just saying that when we look at the New Testament church, it has a lot of the characteristics of other organizations. Now, the difference is that who made the rules for the Rotary Club was a bunch of guys in Chicago a century ago. Who made the rules and the description for the Lord's church is none other than the Lord himself. And so that's the main difference. I'm just saying that when we look at what is the church, it looks a lot like many other local organizations that you care to talk about. And if there are other things that it ought to be doing, then again, what's the text? Where are the passages that would tell us that we need to do that? So I'm going to date myself. Vicki talked this morning or tried to talk about S&H green stamps or yellow stamps and said nobody knows what that is. Well, this is a little more recent than that, but some of you might recall an ad campaign a number of years ago about 7-Up, which was billed as the Un-Cola. It's not a cola. It's different from a cola. It's not caffeine-free and all that kind of stuff, and actually in some ways it is, but you get the point. They're trying to distinguish themselves as a product by saying, this is what we're not. And the Lord's church is not a human denomination. It's not a group of people that has a creed that was written by a bunch of men. It's not a denomination or a religious body of any kind that is overseen by a hierarchy of officials who you can't read anything about in the Bible. So in the same sense that you can get an un-cola, I'm suggesting you can have an un-denomination, if you will. And an undenomination would be something that doesn't have a headquarters that tells a bunch of churches what to do with a bunch of denominational bureaucrats. It doesn't have a hierarchy with a junior bishop and an archbishop and a senior bishop and then a universal papa or pope over all of them. It doesn't have archbishops, doesn't have clergy of any kind. You don't have to be ordained or have a seminary degree or anything like that. And in fact, there are no I can't read about any. In fact, Paul was evidently went to rabbinical school, but that was probably held against him more than anything. There's no creed, and I guess no caffeine either. But the idea is, you know, if that's not a denomination, what would it take not to be a denomination? If you lack all of the characteristics of what make a denomination, which are creeds and headquarters and hierarchy and archbishops and so forth and so on, and you don't have any of that, then what would it take to be a non-denomination, if you will? So let me ask this question. What does the church do? Well, let's look at a text in Ephesians chapter 4, for example, where we read a description of the church in some ways as a body. And I'll suggest that what this text tells us is that it assembles, it evangelizes, it has their various ministries, it edifies itself, and so forth and so on. And then I will ask some questions about that. Look at Ephesians chapter 4, verse 11. He gave some as apostles and prophets and evangelists and pastors, elders, shepherds, and teachers. Why? For the equipping of the saints. For the building up of the saints. This word equipping is a word that's also used in Mark 1:19 of the mending of nets. Something is broken or frayed and it needs to be mended. It was used in secular Greek literature about the setting of a broken bone. Your bone has been broken. It needs to be splinted or set in a cast or something like that. Same word that's used here. This is for the mending, the building up, the maintenance, if you will, of the saints. For the work of service, in order that they might serve their fellow Christians and others as well, in order that we might do service to the building up of the body of Christ. Like 1 Corinthians 12, another text, the image of the body here with different functions, with the head and the hands and the feet and the eyes and so forth. 1 Corinthians 12, Paul says, actually the more important parts of the body are the unseemly parts, parts that are really not that. I mean, the hand is a wonderfully complex organ and mechanism, as is the eye or the ear or whatever. But think about the brain or the heart or the liver. You can live and function without a hand. You can't live without your heart. You can live without feet, even without eyes or ears, but you can't function without some of these internal parts. And so what Paul is saying is sometimes we pay greater honor to the things that we can see in the body and things that people that do things publicly and who may preach or lead singing. But just as important are the individuals who are behind the scenes doing things that are equally important for the building up of the body, for the teaching of individuals in the church and so forth. That's the analogy that he's using here. And then he goes on to say, in verse 13, until we all attain to the unity of the faith, this is a growth process, if you will, till we attain to the unity of the faith, to the knowledge of the Son of God, to a mature person, to a full-grown, fully functioning body, no longer infants, no longer living on infant formula, if you will, but grown to consume the meat of the word and functioning as an adult, to the measure of the stature which belongs to the fullness of Christ. That's the purpose for all of these things. But I'll ask these questions. Does this text tell us that we ought to be engaged in social welfare activities, that we ought to become a sort of a cross between a country club and a social service agency? Are we supposed to relieve everybody in the world? Are we supposed to cure diseases? Is that the function of the church? And so forth and so on. That I don't read anything about that in the New Testament. Now let me talk for just a moment about just some common sense things about how this happens. There are at least, if you look at any kind of organization, any kind of a group, in order for it to function as individuals coming together in a group, you've got to have at least three elements. There has to be agreement to work together. We are going to do this project or that activity and we're going to do it together. And then it requires some pooling of resources. And it requires, thirdly, an acceptance of common oversight or direction. Let me use a very simple example. If we want it to move this pulpit or that table, let's say the pulpit, we want to move it somewhere. So we decided this pulpit needs to be moved. So we've agreed that I can't move it, and so it's going to take four sturdy guys to come up here and move this pulpit. Now, we've agreed we're going to move it. We need to pool our resources, in this case some form of energy, to lift and move it somewhere. But where are we going to move it? If each of these four guys grabs a corner and takes off in four different directions, this is not going to go very far. So somebody's going to have to say, one, two, three, lift, and we're going in that corner and not in that corner. That's just a very common illustration of how cooperative action, collective action works. You have to agree to work together. You have to pool resources, and then you have to have in this common mindset an acceptance of some kind of oversight or direction in the church, hopefully elders. In the absence of that, brethren have to agree to work together. Usually we pool our resources by the means of financial, the collection of money, which allows us then to negotiate for individuals to turn on the lights and install the carpet so that we can, or the pews. I mean, we could sit on the floor, you know. But probably it's more convenient to sit on pews and so forth. So what these individual Christians did, this is just a very, you may not even be able to read all of this, but they met to do all these things that we've talked about earlier in the first four or five, observe the supper, pray and sing together, to hear preaching and teaching from the word, to learn from teachers and so forth. We find them discussing problems and working out these solutions as we talked about in Acts 15 this morning. They disciplined their members, as we saw in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, and so forth and so on. And they did that, caring for needy saints, which was not the primary work of the church, but it was on a shared faith basis with a clear knowledge of need. Go back and read 2 Corinthians chapter 8, and shows actually the priority of spiritual needs over physical needs. Now, I wanted to get to something else, but I'm going to run out of time, so I'm going to edit here. How do we get from that picture to where we are today? In some instances, I've called this part of the lesson, where did we get all these churches? Where did all these denominations come from? And, of course, it starts, I'm going to briefly take 2 minutes to talk about this. Tomorrow night we'll pick up this story. It starts with the Roman Catholic Church, and it's takeover of many congregations and organizing them into a hierarchy, and then its division from east to west with the Orthodox churches, the Greek Orthodox, Lithuanian Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, which are ethnic group churches. And then in the 15th, 16th centuries, and a little before that, you get different Protestant groups, Lutheran churches, Calvinistic churches like Presbyterian and Baptist, and then the Anglican churches that we talked about this morning, Episcopalian, Puritans, and in America, the Methodist bodies that John Wesley started. And then you get other smaller groups, actually some of them pretty fast growing, like Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses and so forth. Those are kind of the three main divisions of Christendom, if you will. And Christianity looked at in this way, all of the groups of all of the people who call themselves Christians. Now, that doesn't mean that all of them have done what the New Testament says to become a Christian, but if you look at that, it's still the largest religion in the world. And it's not only the largest, not Islam, but it's not only the largest. I thought I had a world map in here somewhere. There it is. It's also the fastest growing. Islam is not the fastest growing, despite a lot of their publicity and so forth. Christianity, especially in these third world countries, is just growing like Topsy. Now, again, not everybody who calls himself a Christian has actually done everything the New Testament says. But the largest of these religions, of the largest of these Christian groups, of course, is Roman Catholicism. That's true in the United States. And there are all sorts of studies that actually break down on a county-by-county basis of what is the largest religious body in that particular area. And the Roman Catholic Church, at about 50 million members, is the largest of these bodies in America. It's also the largest of the bodies in the religious bodies in the world. Now, if you put all of the Protestant groups together, The next largest group would actually be the Southern Baptist Convention, the biggest collection of Protestant churches, and then it would be followed probably by the United Methodist Church and then some other groups like that. If you put all of them together, that's about 70 million people. So Protestants as a collective group outnumber Roman Catholics, but as individual denominations, the Roman Catholic Church is the largest individual denomination in the world and in the country. And what they did was basically through a process that they call apostolic succession, that Peter was the first pope and then the papacy got passed down. Rather than Jesus being the head of these churches at Corinth and Athens and so forth, as these texts say, he put all things under his feet, gave him to be the head over all things to the church, which is his body. Acts 20 teaches the same thing. They appointed elders in every church, and that's been replaced with a hierarchy. I've used that word several times. Here's what a hierarchy looks like. Jesus is not the head of the church in the sense of Roman Catholicism, but the Pope, the vicar of Christ on earth, the representative of Christ on earth, is actually the head of that. And all of these religious divisions begin with this kind of basic idea and then splinter into all of the different kind of Protestant churches. And I'll have to wait until tomorrow night. So if you want to know about that, come back tomorrow evening. If you want to bring some friends and neighbors who may be in religious denominations, I'm going to try to be as inoffensive as possible, but we're going to talk about how did these denominations get started and why did they get started and are they biblical? And those are the kinds of things. So if you have friends and neighbors that think you think maybe they need to hear that kind of message, bring them, and I'll be happy to talk with anyone who has questions about that. You've been very attentive tonight. I appreciate that very much. I'm going to ask you now to take out your hymnal. The hour has nearly come around, and I'm going to abide by the old rule that the mind can absorb only what the seat can endure. So we're going to extend the invitation. If it's the case that there is one or more in the audience tonight who needs to obey the gospel, to name the name of Christ, to accept him as the Savior of the world, but to accept him as the one who saves each and every one of us individually, and to make that good confession that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, and having repented, turning away from sin, going the other direction, to be baptized for the remission of sins. In a figure of Christ's death and burial and resurrection to life again, we die to sin, we're buried with the Lord in baptism, we arise to walk in newness of life. Or if you've done those things already, but you've not been walking in newness of life, you have not strayed from the Lord, not doing the things that you should, would you come back to him in penitence and in prayer? He'll own you and forgive you, just as happened with the prodigal in Luke 15. If you need to do those things, come and make it known as we're standing to sing the hymn.